Sandra, and Noah.
Hello, hello, and welcome back to the Theater World Presents podcast. My name's Noah Bender.
And I'm Sandra Nemchik.
And our guest this week is an accomplished actor and director who has worked on stages all over the Bay Area, regionally, on TV, and on Broadway. She most recently appeared in Steel Magnolias at Theater Works Silicon Valley and made her Broadway debut in the 2022 revival of 1776. She's fabulous, baby. Please welcome Dawn Troop.
Woohoo! Hey, guys. Good to be here. How are you?
We're so happy to have you.
So excited. Yeah, you've been on our list to have on our show for quite some time now, and we're glad to finally make it happen.
I am so happy that we made it happen. Nice to meet you, Noah. And Zan and I have been on text for quite a while, back and forth, and, you know, from cancellations to I could use an assistant. Has come into
That's okay.
play.
Yeah. I mean, like, when you were going to be doing our interview last year, you were like, oh, I'm almost going to be doing 1776. And we're like, when's that happening? And then you're like, I'm in it now. And then we're like, oh, okay. So when are you going to be available? And then you're like, maybe when it's done. So it's been a while, but we're here.
Yes.
All right. So we want to talk about your origin story, your kind of transition into becoming a professional actor, because Zan tells me you had a whole career as a teacher before kind of making
the leap.
What was the kind of thing that spurned you to say, wait a minute, I can do this full time. I can do this as my capital C career.
Well, first of all, my jump into professional acting, two parts. My jump into professional acting came from my stint at Ohlone College. Mm-hmm. And my professor, Tom Blank, still a dear friend of mine, still quite the coach and fantastic human being that he is, still gives me advice, recommended that I go audition for San Jose Theater.
Mm-hmm. When it was at AMTSJ,
American Musical Theater. That's correct. Oh, Sam, very good. And at that point, I went and auditioned for them. And he also recommended auditioning for this little company called Theater Works.
And I was small.
A small theater.
Not Theater World?
Well, you know.
Not yet. Who knows?
Not yet, but apparently that is the case. But Theater Works, and I met Leslie Martinson and the whole team and booked the gig at AMT, my first professional gig. And I understudied Mary Bond Davis, who said to me, a very young me, I had a young son, and I said, how can I do this for a lifetime? And oh my gosh, no.
Sorry, my cat is coming in the frame. He's right.
Oh, don't say sorry. Let it live, baby, live. Yes, you come if you want to. Oh,
he's coming up behind the computer and nuzzling the microphone.
How cute is he?
Yes, my little cat, a Skimbleshanks, the railway cat.
I love
He's a big
it.
Cats fan.
He's gorgeous. He knows I'm a sucker for animals. Hi, Skimbleshanks.
Yes, of course.
Hi, baby.
But go on.
I booked that gig, understudied Mary Bond Davis, who was the original Motormouth Mary in Hairspray, Hairspray, and a number of other roles. And she told me, you're never too old. When your son is grown, take the chance if it's still what you want to do. Let's go 20 years later. I was teaching in middle school, public schools, theater, while working professionally in the Bay Area, sometimes flying back and forth to New York for Bernie Telsey called. I got called for Rent and back and forth and back and forth. And then my son graduated, went to college, and I left California. Left my career as a teacher and said, I'm going to do this. I also left a marriage. I'm kind of leaving that part out. But
you're leaving everything.
I left everything.
Took a bunch of leaps.
Yeah.
A lot of leaps and a lot of scary, scary moments. But definitely the thing that helped me was a partner who was so supportive. and a family that also fed and nourished me from afar. When I first came to New York, because I'm so close with my family, they all flew out the next holiday, 16 hours, and visited me, and we had like a late Christmas celebration.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
I mean, and now it's kind of coming full circle because you recently made your Broadway debut last year. What was that like, debuting on Broadway in such a, you know, monumental revival of 1776?
It was all the things. Scary, significant, a moment that I'll never forget is recognizing that I was actually standing on a Broadway stage in a
It hits different.
Yeah.
You don't, I was swing for four different roles and four of the most talkative roles on the stage. Well, three of them were.
Did you do Ben Franklin?
John Adams, Ben Franklin, Hancock, and then the courier who didn't have as many lines, but moved on and off the stage the most.
Oh my goodness.
So for four roles, and I'm not built to be a swing. That's just my reality.
The memorization and everything. Like, the memorization. Did you start looking at that?
Had I been a 20 something year old, I think it would have been easier, but I'm not. It was still so significant. I went on for Ben Franklin, you guys, and I realized I was on Broadway.
Yeah.
I heard a roar from the audience.
Oh,
it's different.
And I snapped out of the anxiety for, you know, that moment of going, I am living my dream. This is what I have dreamed of.
Do they make announcements at the beginning? Like, the role of Ben Franklin will be played by?
So it's in all of the pamphlets. They have the wonderful company. Oh, gosh. American Airlines Theater has a beautiful staff, and they come in early and change the program.
Oh, man.
Pages every day, and they change the board. So you walk in, and you see.
Like, who's playing what?
Playing, yes. I have so many photos of that, you know, stepping in for these different.
Yeah, how many times did you go on for everyone else?
So I went on for three characters. I never went on for John Adams. And
that's one... okay. We don't really like him anyway.
Right. I don't have the exact number, but I would say around 20, 25 times or so for the three characters combined.
Yeah, I feel like when you have that kind of, oh my God moment, you've got to like sit in it for like 5 seconds and then just start to do the work. And that probably feels especially prescient for a show like that, where I saw the tour, I didn't see it on Broadway, but the moment at the beginning where you kind of literally step into the shoes of the founding fathers and basically saying, we're leaving our normal selves behind. And inhabiting these, you know, complicated historical figures, that's probably the moment where it all shifts, where it's like, okay, I'm stepping out as Dawn, and I'm becoming whomever.
Noah, that's exactly what was discussed in the room as well. The team,
the workshops,
the rehearsals, because they had done it in Boston already at ART. It had a run before it came to Broadway and before it left for the tour, and that was part of the discussion, that you are literally stepping into the shoes of these four fathers, four figures, and fully recognizing that the bodies look very different and bring the essence of your body and who you are onto that stage, into those shoes, and even down to the, that many of us wore like something significant to us to represent that character while in it. And for me, I wore, because of Ben Franklin's stature and Hancock's wealth, I wore specific rings for the characters. And for the courier, I wore a necklace under my costume. The others were showy, but for the courier, I hid a stone and a necklace that had a lot to do with being rooted in the ground.
Yeah, it's amazing how a kind of hidden object or a very subtle object can kind of ground you into the character more than any kind of textual vantage point.
Yeah. Is there any other warm-ups that you would do before even like stepping into that? Like besides putting something on, is there something that would be like, okay, I'm playing this person now. Like it's different.
Absolutely. I actually have a ritual of going on stage and speaking to the audience before they come. So I literally have a conversation before they arrive, and it's, you can call it a prayer. You can call it affirmations. I sometimes say all kinds of things, but it's basically to manifest the experience I want for this engagement to happen. Mm-hmm. I do that whatever stage I'm on.
Does it happen every time you do it? Like you're just like, this is going to happen. And then you're like, boom, it happens.
So more so than that, Zan, yes. And then sometimes I don't know, because more so than manifesting something for me, I am manifesting for their experience.
Mm-hmm. Right. You gotta make sure they're ready.
Their attention. Mm-hmm. And specifically, I'll just say a little bit that we on stage can't do what we do without the connection with the audience.
Exactly.
And so oftentimes, especially today with these different audiences, you don't know what to expect. The conversations, even the telephones ringing and people answering them, you know, the etiquette is sometimes lost right now. And so me speaking over the audience is that they walk away with an understanding about not just the entertainment of it, but also the opportunity for change.
Mm-hmm. And the significance of it
on
stage.
And the importance of that. Yeah,
well, and that's what 1776 does. It kind of forces people to be reflective of like their role within this country in a grand sense.
What shoes they're putting on and what jackets they want to wear.
Yeah.
What message exactly. Noah, spot on. And those conversations were wonderful to have with the audience afterwards. So sometimes I would hear from them that, oh my God, this was that and this was that for me. And then other times I didn't get to engage with the audience because we had another rehearsal or we had something else come up, you know. And oftentimes you're doing so much around the work that you're not experiencing what the audience is saying. You're just in for the next put in. You're rehearsing for someone else who's about to go in because somebody is about to leave. The cast was huge. It was a huge cast.
And so, right. There's a lot of people going in and out.
A lot of people going in and out. A lot.
Hmm. Well, let's move on. I want to talk about, you have done a lot of early workshops for shows. I want to talk about, you've been in three iterations of Dave Malloy's Moby Dick, a show which, my little personal story, I lived in Boston while it premiered at ART, and I applied for the Today Ticks lottery. I won the Today Ticks lottery. I was gonna go, and then at like 3 p.m. that day, I got an email saying, "Sorry, we actually released too many tickets to this lottery," or something that was like, "Sorry, you won, but you didn't win."
I think I was like, you're gonna see Don Troop.
I know. I wanted to see it so bad because I had read Moby Dick in high school. Yeah. I was just curious. How could this possibly be adapted into a stage musical? Such a dense book with not that much actual story. But yeah, what was that like? Because you were in three iterations of it, right? How did that change and how did that develop as it went on?
So I have to preface diving into that with this. TheaterWorks has been my family for so long. Mm-hmm. And I call it school. I learned so much there. Not just how to be an actor in a musical, but also how to work in straight plays too. And then transfer that connective tissue from a straight play and how rooted you are in the character to my musical theater world as well. So then my desires became different in terms of what kinds of stories I wanted to tell.
Yeah, and theater is so different with musical theater versus plays.
And that I hated hearing the conversation that musical theater was fluff and straight plays were the real thing, you know?
Yeah.
And there's always going to be
Because that's not what Dave Malloy's work is like.
No, Dave Malloy is very, very deep.
Oh, let's go there, right? So yeah. I got practice at Theater Works with Memphis before I ever died.
Yeah, I want to talk about that too, because that's one of my favorite shows that I've ever seen.
So I did three iterations of that show as well. I did the very first workshop with Joe DiPietra, another David from, oh gosh, and I'm losing the name of the band, named after Hair. Oh gosh, you know, the composer for Memphis.
I just remember Joe DiPietro.
Simon? It'll come back to me. Jersey band that David was a part of. But that play workshopped at Theater Works.
WC Handy?
No.
The name we're looking for is David Bryan.
David Bryan. Yep. And he was in the band, and the guy who was the front man, it's named after him. You guys will know it when he's an actor.
Okay.
But anyway, Memphis workshopped twice at Theater Works and then world premiered at Theater Works. Right. And I went from the first one that was such a dramatically different show. I think I played the daughter to the lead woman. They gave her daughter.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting.
And then the second Felicia. Second iteration, no daughter, and I became all these other different characters. Mm-hmm. It was such a blast. And then we put it up on its feet, and then it went to Broadway. And became a smash. And those people I still love today. They're just incredible. And
yeah, James Monroe, Iglehart, all these people.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I went to school with James. He was at Cal State Hayward. We did all kinds of shows.
He's a tried and true Bay Area guy.
He truly is. He's from the Bay Area, like myself. And he actually is back there, I think, going to be directing a show. But I had practice with Theater Works in so many iterations of shows, and New York big directors, composers. It prepared me for the Berkeley rep call for Moby Dick. Mm. And having heard all of this hoopla around Dave Malloy and Rachel Chopkin and Comet, it was huge. And Amy Potockin, who was the casting director at Berkeley Rep, said, "Dawn, we're setting you up for a pretty big role. Are you ready?" And I was like, "I'm ready."
Yeah.
And I showed up having no idea what role I was playing. And it was such a huge what is the word? But it was such a huge vote of confidence I had from I felt from the community that Amy called me to take that
an endowment of sorts.
And Amy still continues to be a wonderful part of my life. I love Amy Totskin, as is Leslie Martinson from Theater Works. The relationships you establish in this industry, hold on to them. You can learn from them even when they stop doing their jobs. Just wonderful people, period. But I stepped into the role, had our workshop at Berkeley Rep. You guys, the first time I did any of the work, I was on atop a ladder at the very top of this very maybe 8-foot tall ladder, speaking over the audience, and we had to read our scripts. My entrance into the world to bring everybody in was 12 pages.
Oh, damn. Boy.
Dialogue. Dave took it from that. Dave and Rachel took it from that to what we did at ART. God damn it, I'm so sad you missed it, Noah.
I know, I wanted to see it so bad.
And it was a complete, you were immersed in the world. You didn't just you didn't just hear it and see it. You experienced it. And
so you were under the sea or something like that? Like Little Mermaid?
Even better, we brought the water and the whale up. So you got to put your hands in gel that was like the belly of, you know, after the whale is killed. So you don't even realize you're on the boat slaughtering a whale. You're just playing. And it's just a hoot. You're sprayed with water.
There's a splash zone.
There's a splash zone. We actually had a splash zone. Wow. And we put raincoats on the audience and pushed them around in boats that came up from underneath the floor. Oh my God,
that sounds so fun.
It was so much fun. And then even down to the puppetry, we had a puppet master, I can't think of his name, gorgeous individual, his soul was gorgeous, who created these puppets made from recycled wares, because it's not just a reckoning in terms of who we are as human beings, it's what we're doing to the planet.
And you throw a lot of that trash in the ocean.
And a lot of that trash is in the ocean, and they wanted to draw attention to that. Mm. And so Rachel brought in this puppeteer who created these life-size, huge whales and other props that we toted around, like kids in a elementary school production, but of puppets. There's one scene where we just used the puppets. You guys, I was trying to look for this text I got from a friend of mine whom I love, Andrew. He sent me a text this morning. And it was a mug with our cup in it, our names. And he said, every time I pick this mug up, I think about Dawn LT. This is my love.
What does it say?
Oh, that's cute.
Oh,
we are all in the belly of the whale.
And that came from one of the songs that I sang in the show. Mm-hmm. And it has such significance, because when we spoke to the audience as they were leaving, they were in the whale. Once you experience and hear that language that Dave created, that visual that Rachel, manifested on that stage, you have to walk away changed.
Yeah, they've kind of carved their own path in the landscape of theater in terms of creating truly immersive experiences that go beyond just sitting in a seat and, watching people do text on stage.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. It serves a greater, it serves people like me, because I have problems with attention, keeping my attention. And
a lot of people do nowadays,
too. A lot
of
people do these days, right? And I don't want to, I'm not going to self-diagnose, but I have often been distracted easily. Mm-hmm. And I've never been diagnosed with ADD or ADHD. But my mind is constantly looking and searching for the next stimulation. Stimulate, right? And even today, more so with these phones and contraptions. Mm-hmm. But they make the experience so visceral.
Yeah, but you can't look at your phone or whatever.
You don't have time to. You'll miss something.
Right.
Yeah.
In that moment. And if you're missing a connective tissue to the next moment. So it's like,
why not bring the actress into the audience and make you a part of it?
I danced, I was four or five different captains on the ship, on the water, on the sea. And that song, that line, "We are all in the belly of the whale," is a pretty funny, upbeat song that has really dire consequences if you're not listening. Mm-hmm. That you're going down with the whale, and it's like this upbeat song that I get to sing at the very top of the show, and everybody's like, yeah, yeah, but you don't really, if you're not paying attention, it's like, hey, listen up.
Well, yeah. It's so, the subtext of that show is so existential. It's all about, what does it mean to have a purpose? What does it mean to be alive? What does it mean to need something, to search for something?
Right.
It's amazing how those kind of ideals can be translated from such a dense book, Moby Dick, which you read it and you say, wait a minute, there's been 75 pages without any dialogue. What's going on here? And to kind of translate that kind of abstract imagery of like, yeah, some of it is just like a textbook about a whale.
But
it's bigger than a whale.
It's much, much
bigger.
It's
about life. It's about the earth.
Yes.
So another really monumental moment was Melville's great-grandson came to see the play.
Oh, that's cool.
And
what was the connection like with that?
It was powerful. But he pulled myself and another actor aside at the end, thanked us for our performance, and said, please give my, this is going to sound really morbid, But he said, please give my condolences to Dave, and I offer them to you as well, because now that you know, you cannot ever unknow.
Wow, that's deep.
And he said that's how his great-grandfather was lost. Once he had that reckoning with...
He had to tell a story. Yeah. And use metaphors. It's kind of like a big parable, right?
It is a huge parable. And just the way Dave Malloy and Rachel brought it to life, you guys, can you imagine? And the breadth and width of this idea, but to imagine placing so much on the shoulders of a little Pip.
Mm-hmm.
And him being on a ship, translating languages with all of these people who don't look like him, no one who is his age, and we're not going to even go into the abuses that would be happening, and to be lost at sea before you're lost at sea, when you're alive and a child. The reckoning of just thinking about that was sometimes too much. So it's, you better start with a song that's upbeat. Mm-hmm. Dave had he knew how to weave it together, you guys, so beautifully that you get tricked into the, we are all, into the clapping.
Do you see a future for that show? Like, I feel like with Dave Malloy's work, it can only be accented by being scaled up even more.
Can you say that again a little louder, Noah, to Dave Malloy?
Broadway.
So you know what? Here is my, Andrew sent this note this morning. We were just talking about it, that this needs to be put up again. The world needs to hear this tale.
I can see it.
So you can see it. Yet.
And I can see it.
Noah, just for you. And Zan, of course, we got you. We need you to get those two tickets back. Actually, you should because of that experience.
Yeah, but I know. They really stiffed me.
I know. I'm really sorry because that was so much fun and experimenting. We sang it underneath the whale at
exactly.
the museum, and I was like, oh, this is incredible.
Oh,
but the
wow.
PRT experience with everybody, seeing kids old and young, like gray hair people behaving like little kids in a boat, as well as the little kids behaving like little kids, can't beat it.
No, how did you guys interpret the whale, Moby Dick? Like, how did you interpret that on stage?
Oh, in a number of ways. And actually, Noah, I want to finish, Noah. Zan, hold on to that. But
go ahead.
There's a future for it. And I just think the there's always difficulties, even though this show was superb, it was great, it was wonderful, powerful. There's always hardships. And that may go on behind the scenes that you might not know about. And what needs to happen is that show does need to come back, because the music, the story, and Dave's soul is on display. He gave opportunity. It was my first time working with people who were a Persian role. It was a Persian actor.
Mm-hmm.
A Native American role. It was a Native American actor. Yo, this was like profoundly such a revolutionary experience for so many of us.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I played the role, a Black woman, who is a mother, I wear so many hats, played all these white male characters. I wore the different hats. And at the deepest root, it was about humanity.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, I recognized, oh my God, I've never worked with someone who's stepping into the role that was written for them.
Mm-hmm. It's transformational that way, and it makes things so much better.
What? It's a universal situation
exactly.
instead of just like people are people no matter what they look like.
That's right. It was a gorgeous experience. I've been doing this for so long, and often that is not the conversation, that you get to see somebody representing themselves in a play when Hollywood and theater would rather put somebody that is going to bring in money. So recognizing that
there's no value in playing it safe anymore.
What I think that only belongs on the baseball field. Call it what it is.
Oh,
safe. Right when they yeah. cross home base. Right. Otherwise, yeah. who's really safe? We need to be practicing psychological safety.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
And creating that, and that's an act. It's not just
and healing traumas.
Yes. Dealing with the traumas, actually addressing them. Hire mm-hmm. a Persian, hire a Native American, hire some more BIPOC gender fluid people. Let's move it forward.
And that's what seems like it made 1776 so meaningful, is because you have all these, you know, non-white, non-male people stepping into these roles and totally reinterpreting Ben Franklin and John Adams mm-hmm. and yeah. you know Thomas Jefferson in ways that bring entirely new context to this myth that we've told ourselves.
The myth that we've told ourselves. I love that. There's so many myths that are in that show, just embedded mm-hmm. in it, and what we believe. And one of the last lines Ben Franklin says, you know, who are we, gods? No, we're men. And it's literally like, wake up. These are men who wrote this Constitution.
Yeah.
Men
who wrote the musical too.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
There's fault in that.
Yeah. I found it so interesting watching 1776, you know, interpreting it with the kind of modern lens in which, you know, we have a much different relationship to our government and to our national history than in 1969 when that show was written, right. with much more, I think, earnest reverence,
right.
Than it might be interpreted yeah. now.
Exactly.
Like, we don't have that kind of same reverence for our history, and that deserves to be explored.
No, well, you know.
Well, in some locations, though, I feel like there
in
are
some parts you know, of the yeah, in some parts of the world, they're still I
on a pedestal.
Think about how religion and politics, how closely related they are, and during that time, God is woven all throughout the Constitution because of it. And today, even that has changed.
Yeah, it's well, shifted. And the way that people look at the Founding Fathers as infallible figures that are to be unquestioned.
That's unquestioned. And in those two worlds, faith and politics, they're crossing over. You can't question. And now this generation and the generation prior have been pushing the envelope
mm-hmm.
to change that. So I'm appreciative of the approach that they took. There were some things that I still would have loved to have seen in that show, if I'm going to be honest. I wanted to see more use made of the non-binary story, if they're
mm-hmm.
the trans story is in the world, the cast in the show. I wanted to see more massaged out of that.
Yeah, my friend Sav Souza, who I know from theater camp, was in every iteration of that show. It was
exactly.
amazing to see them.
And that's what I mean. I wanted to see more brought out of that conversation, whereas mm-hmm. you're not just hiring the body because it represents some desire you want.
Because yeah, but sometimes I felt like that revival was a bit limited by the text, which is so. It's
limited by putting it out on Broadway. If you wanted to like put it out, you know, how yeah. far can you push it? You know.
Yeah, that actually, Zan, is more to the point because there are legal things at play with regards to how far you can push it. So,
right, and just being labeled woke 1776.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of people have called that what you were in.
Right, right. Woke. And now that even that's been
weaponized.
Hijacked
yeah.
and weaponized.
It's the new feminist thing.
Oh, what? Don't say that word. That's yeah. a word too. So we get easily distracted by creating stigmas around language instead of really dealing with a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we could have done an even greater job expanding that story visually, even if it's not in the text, in telling a story around trans bodies, non-binary bodies in this show, in that show in particular.
Well, shall we move on to our theater world lightning
Absolutely.
Round?
Let's do it.
I don't know. I haven't really had anything substantial to eat, to wake me? Let me see. We can go. We can try it.
Okay. All well, right. here's a really substantial question that I'm sure you'll be able to make some meat out of. Okay. Dawn, who is your favorite Broadway diva?
Oh my God. Who's my favorite Broadway diva? Right now, the first one that it's always going to be our Fresno queen. And I just went up on her name, Ragtime.
Oh, Audra McDonald?
Audra McDonald's one of my favorites.
It's amazing.
But the other, she came to mind, but the one with the she's dyed her hair blonde. She's British. Her right now, she's one of my favorites.
What's she in?
Color Purple.
Cynthia Erivo?
Cynthia
Erivo. Yeah, she's in Wicked.
Yes, that one. So let's go with Cynthia Erivo.
Yeah, what a powerful voice.
What a powerful presence. She knocked out.
Yeah, I'd love to see her live.
Yeah, that one.
All right, next question.
Next one.
What is your dream role?
My dream role? I don't think it's been written yet.
Good answer. I feel like we've heard a couple people say that. That's a good way to phrase that.
Yeah, because I want to play an empowered woman who isn't solely cast because she's Black, because she's a mother. Although those components can be, a part of it. But I want a powerful woman whose story needs to
just
be
transcendent told. Of all that.
That's exactly. Rugrats the musical. Here we come.
There you go.
What?
I don't know. I was like, exactly something that's nothing. Like just like that's it.
You can play a baby on stage.
Even more so, give me a kick-ass, silly musical that has levity and that is really has some sci-fi elements to it, or even like some superhero elements.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, haven't had a lot of superheroes. Just Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark.
No, and not enough mature women who still bring a punch.
Exactly. Yeah.
Are you going to be flying around and everything?
Oh, yeah, Noah. I want to fly. I want to skate.
You could be Wonder Woman.
I want to swim across. I just want to do it all. So it hasn't been written yet. I want to do all of it. All right.
Let's bring back Starlight Express so you can skate
around.
Oh,
my God. Yo, I have my purple skates here in the back already.
Oh, perfect.
Ready.
She's ready for Starlight Express, the revival.
Right. That's right.
Immersive. Rachel directs.
Come on. Oh my God. If Rachel did it, it's dope.
Yeah, they already have to retool the theater to do Starlight Express. They might as well just add more elements of immersive quality.
Keep your hands and arms and legs inside while they skate around.
Guys, that's why I want to see Here Lies Love.
Come on. Yeah.
Talk about immersion and equity. We are first all Filipino cast about a Filipino. Come on. I'm in.
Amazing.
Next question. What is a song, moment, or show that always makes you cry?
Aida.
I love that show.
When she's talking to her people while imprisoned.
Yeah. Is that Easy as Life?
It's
or easy. No, that's...
It's
Dance
no,
the Ropes.
It's
knowing of they want of me.
Yes.
That scares me.
Yes, that one. Thank you. I played Aida. Like I should know that.
Yeah.
But it's that the Dance of the Ropes?
Yes.
I think so.
That's the Dance of the Ropes. That one.
Yeah. They should bring that back.
Yeah, that would be a great show to revive.
Oh my God.
Yeah, there's so many complex moments in that show where characters have to say, I can't be who you need me to be,
or you don't know who I am.
Yeah.
You don't know who I am enough to ask me to be everything that you need me to be.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
Taking what both of you are saying, and there's because you don't want to rely on yourself. You'd rather rely on something outside of yourself. It's so much deeper than that because she was there to help her people,
right?
But also
to help herself to
learn what she needed to get and survive.
Yeah, and what happens when your true love is your oppressor?
Come on.
Yeah, that was the first show where I met Xandra. When we did that show at mm-hmm. at the Hillbarn Conservatory in 2012. I was Mareb.
Get out.
Yeah.
He had a really good death scene. Everyone cried for that.
Yeah, I got to get stabbed. It was great for my 14-year-old self.
Doesn't Mareb have a great song as well?
Yeah.
Yeah.
How I know you. Yes, I know you.
Yeah. Always that one. That's another one that would make me cry. That one there.
Yeah, because that's a tragic character as well.
Oh my God, completely. I was the West Coast. I was the West Coast Aida premiere Aida Ooh. When it was released from Broadway, and I'm so proud of that. But I was ever proud to manifest that show because I would play it while driving from Los Angeles back to the Bay Area for auditions and whatnot for. Mm-hmm. Every single trip, I would just drive down 6 hours there, listening to Aida, 6 hours back, listening to Aida. So I knew the show.
That yeah. I mean, Heather Headley is one of the overall divas as well.
Yes. Saw her three times.
Oh, my goodness.
So I saw her, I saw Deborah Cox, and I even saw Toni Braxton as Aida.
Oh, wow.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did they lower the key for Toni Braxton?
They lowered the key. And and she lowered her gaze, which was really an interesting thing to watch. Anyway, she's a beautiful singer, but I was like, come on.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I wish I could have seen.
The key change is different.
Yeah, yeah.
I wish I could have seen Heather Headley in the new revival of Into the Woods as the witch.
She's incredible. Oh, you guys, I have to tell you, when I saw Heather Headley the very first time, I had my hair pulled back and I forget, but I was much thinner. And I was at the show, walked outside the theater at the end of the night, and the fear that filled my body. Backstage, I wanted to see Heather and I wanted to see, from Rent to
Adam Pascal. I saw him in Memphis.
Oh my God. My God. Yeah. So I went backstage. I went to the backstage door. And when I went to the backstage door, my girlfriend and I walked up and the crowd went like this. Makes me laugh. The crowd looking at the door saw me and went like this. The whole group.
Huh?
And oh. Joanne said, "They think you're Heather. Run."
Yeah.
And then the door opened because people started moving towards us. Then the door opened and Heather came out and like, I literally was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Is that the energy? That's scary as hell. Mm-hmm. Like a lady with a pie was coming towards me. It was so funny, but not.
I'd take the pie.
We laughed afterwards. Yeah, I would have taken the pie, but not that crowd moving.
Yeah. Towards. Thank you.
No, thank
you.
That's
it.
Joanne was. She made me laugh. She was like, "Run!"
That's awesome.
Yeah, and Adam got to sneak out because of that distraction, but I caught him. Yeah.
Beautiful.
Really fun.
And Zan, our final question.
What is the single greatest experience you've ever had at the theater?
This could be on stage, backstage, as a spectator. The first thing that comes to your head, the greatest moment of your entire life
in the theater. Oh, that's so hard.
I know.
I think it might have, you know what? The greatest, let me just say this. It'll be my very first audition.
Hmm. What was that like?
I was scared to death. Didn't think. I always wanted to be a singer, and mm-hmm. I grew up in the church and whatnot, and was definitely told that, you know, this world that I live in was not the world that I should be in because it was full of sin. I, in college, was asked by my professor, Tom Blank, to come audition for a play that had music. And I was like, I don't think you want me. I sing in a rhythm and blues band. I don't think you want my voice. I was just thinking Julie Andrews type of musical.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because I hadn't seen myself in musicals, you guys. I grew up in a world where there weren't a lot of people of color in musicals at all. So I went, oh, yeah, you don't want me. And he said, no, I'm asking you. I heard you sing with a band and I want you to come sing. And I was like, oh, Tom, okay, I'll try. I went to sing and I went on stage, you guys. I was so terrified. I closed my eyes and I said, go ahead and play. And I sang and my eyes started crying. I was in tears.
Oh.
And I was saying an Aaliyah Adams song. And when I opened my eyes at the end, Tom was in tears and everybody else in the house was as well. And Tom cast me as a lead in that show.
And then he said, you need to open your eyes for the show, though.
And the rest is history.
And the rest is history.
And wow. The rest is history.
Yeah. Yeah. And but there's so many more. But that was, yeah, that opened my eyes figuratively and literally.
Yeah. That seems really transformational.
It was completely. And saying yes to that experience. Yeah. Yes to fear.
Yeah. And now I'm sure you're not afraid of anything now.
Oh, absolutely not. And yeah, no, I still am not afraid of so many things in the sea. Absolutely.
Yeah, you just like show up to an audition. You're like, here,
you know,
there you go.
Time to knock it out of the park, darling.
Yeah, I got this.
I will say this. The auditions are the work. That's what we prepare for. But what theater has also given me is I do say yes to a whole lot more that I never did. I never used to.
It makes you learn about yourself and learn how to process your own life.
It makes you dig deep when you can't stay surface if you want to do a good job.
Yeah.
So I take that experience in my own life and I dig deep. Hmm. You guys, this is lovely. Thank you. Do you want to go for number 40? No, I'm teasing.
I think this is a good place to end on.
No, that was a great message for our listeners.
And yeah, thank you so much, Dawn, for coming on our show. We had a lovely time going deep with you and going below the surface and going into the belly of the whale, as it were.
Thanks for that invite.
Yes. Is there anything you'd like to promote while we're here?
Oh, I have recently been working on a short of my own. It is not a musical. It is a film. Mm-hmm. And it's dealing with mental illness and the world of how religion sometimes deals with mental illness.
That's all. Interesting.
But we're going to be submitting to festivals. For theater, I'm actually doing some other work right now, so not as much theater at the moment. But I will reach out if I have some news. And I will definitely reach out. This is a promise, theater world. I will definitely reach out and let you guys know when we need to get back on the mic to interview for Moby Dick. Okay.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Get back on the pickwad.
I'll bring some friends along.
Oh, fun. Oh my gosh.
Well, we're excited for part two. And you know, we've got all your social media and all your links in the description of this episode. And of course, if you're not already following us on social media, we're at theaterworld_presents. That's where we've got all of our posts and links and previews and everything. And we'll see you next time on the Theater World Podcast. Thank you so much, Dawn. And
Thank
we'll
you.
Say ta-ta. Bye-bye, everyone.
Thank you.